When we think about post-traumatic stress, we often think about medication, and we think about doctors, and we think about hospitals, and we think about only being able to take the medication that they give us. And while it is not my job to challenge doctors and their advice, it is my job to enlighten you on what I think is the key element in trying to heal yourself from anything. And that is deciding that you are going to get better. Deciding that you are not going to allow your circumstances to rule you. Deciding that you are going to take your life and change it for the better. Today, my co-host Andrew Marr and I speak about this issue. We talk about some of the success stories he's gotten from his work with the Warrior Angels Foundation. Andrew is a retired Special Forces operator who started the Warrior Angels Foundation to what he says, fight for the medically oppressed. And I think that's what we're truly dealing with right now. People who are being limited by the military medical model. A major component of what we talk about is that process of decision. We also get into some of the other things that play a role in creating the symptoms of PTS and depression. Things like nutrition, things like hormones, things like exercise, or lack of exercise. But above all, we talk about taking charge and leading ourselves toward recovery. So without further delay, let's get into episode 28 of the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is Chris Albert, and I'm here to remind you of one thing. Someday, you're going to die. Now, that's not some morbid statement or scary idea. It's solid fact. Your time here on this earth is limited. And you need to be reminded of this as much as possible for one simple reason. To live your best life while you can. This is the Warrior Soul Podcast. What's going on, everybody? This is Chris Albert, and welcome to the Warrior Soul Podcast. This is episode 28. My God, 28 episodes we've done. Seems like yesterday when we were just getting this thing started. I'm here with my brother, my pal, Andrew Marr, and we've just had some really awesome things happening over here at Warrior Soul. Tony and I just got back from London. Andrew just got back from Orlando, Florida, where he was attending a conference. Tony and I were actually out meeting with London Real, Brian Rose from London Real. And we, took part in their super focus group. I've been one of Brian's instructors for his business accelerator course for a while. And Tony and I both got interviewed. One of the interviews is up on our blog right now, and Tony's interview will be up later on this week. But man, really exciting trip. Got to see a lot about London Real itself and some of the people involved in that organization and the people who are fans, and they're absolutely amazing people. Tony and I got really fired up. We got some awesome videos out there on YouTube just about our hijinks in London and things like that. But we have some more important business at hand right now. And to be honest with you guys, we were going to do a show with somebody today, and that person decided to cancel on us last minute. But Andrew and I just wanted to come on and talk about, one, some of the victories he's having over there with the Warrior Angels Foundation, some of the amazing things he's doing for veterans and helping them to battle things like traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. And two, we want to get into some of these new things that we're getting into. Andrew over the weekend learned quite a bit about the ketogenic diet. And a lot of you might know I've been an advocate for the ketogenic diet for a while. I've also written about it for quite an extent, so we'll get into that too. And we're going to be getting into some of the different techniques and things like that that you can use to really improve your energy all day long. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on, just simple things that you can do every day, just so your day is not dragging on, so that you can be your best self, when you want to be. You know, you can't always be your best self, but you can create the conditions that are going to facilitate your ability to perform like the best you can. So Andrew, brother, how are you doing, man?
Man, Chris, I'm doing amazing, and following you guys through your London escapades, and looked like a great time. One-legged, you know, pistol squats and drinking mushroom coffee and working out and in and out of the London Real Academy, Buckingham Palace. You guys are crazy all over the place. So enjoyed watching that. I got an incredible update from one of the guys that we're supporting through the foundation, and it's kind of what Chris was alluding to earlier, but I just wanted to share what this young man wrote, because it does a great, it really hammers through the point of the decline that somebody can go through from post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury, and then how they can pull themselves out of that, and then what is life like once they return to a level where they can function at a higher level, you know? And so without saying too much more, I'll read it. And it's going to take a few minutes, but bear with me, because I think you're really being moved by this this moving testimonial that we got. And then we're going to dissect it further afterwards. So here it goes. Andrew, got off the horn with a doc the other day after my labs, and it looks like my body is responding very well to treatment. I wanted to share with you that I got approved for vocation rehab through the VA, and I'm just finishing my first semester at a college in Nevada. This is significant because this is my fifth attempt at college since I discharged from the Marine Corps in 2007. This is the first time ever that I'm taking a full load on campus, 15 hours, and I'm making A's and B's without having dropped a class. Sure, I struggle a lot, but it is shocking how well I have been able to cope. Historically, I burn out after midterms and drop out. This year, though, I felt the itch. I stuck it through. Physically, I am strong. I had to drop my regular training program when school started, which sucks, but I plan to start back up next week after finals. Before school, though, I was reaching a pinnacle of strength that I had not realized in many years after starting the treatment last spring. I remember the first week after treatment, I added an exercise at the gym for each lifting day. After the second week, I added another. I didn't stop all summer. I was loving the amount of challenge I could add to my plate and still meet with gains. I still hit the pull-up bar when I can, and I noticed the other week that despite my interruption in training, I've not lost much strength. It seems like my muscles don't atrophy as fast as they used to, and I'm much more active in general. Before, fatigue could wipe me out for days. No longer. Other good news, with voc rehab in school, I'm realizing my dream career goal of being a national park ranger in Alaska. Over the past 2 months, I've scraped, scrounged, wheeled and dealed my way into a backcountry ski kit. It is the kit that I have wanted for 15 years, and I wrote it off as a pipe dream. My bindings come in next Tuesday, and from there, I am good to go. Next semester, I take a full course in backcountry skiing, as well as avalanche and wilderness first responder certification. I'm also looking into taking ice climbing certification outside of college. As of now, I'm looking to take a job as beginning mountaineering guide on Mount Shasta next summer. Last year, I would have never believed that my body would be able to undertake the rigors of the high alpine day in and day out. This year, I feel stronger than ever. I have set a goal for myself to summit Mount Denali by the age of 40. It's what gets me out of bed in the morning and has become quite the motivation of mine in everything I do. I stopped dreaming this big years ago. In other news, I picked up my trumpet that I never thought I would play again. I started studying the game of chess with my brother. I read more books now for fun in a month than I used to in a year. I have taken up again my study of history and prehistory. I have started to rock climb and snowshoe. I, get this, have even made a civilian friend or two at college. In short, I've taken up several hobbies when before there were none but group and individual therapy appointments. All this is on top of school. Just last fall, I used to dread how long the days were. Now it's upsetting every day how fast time flies because there is so much I want to do and experience. What a transition. It's simply fucking amazing, Andrew. From parents and siblings to friends and acquaintances, I would say that nobody really recognizes who I have become in such a short time this year. I must admit, I become emotional just thinking about this shit. In July 2014, I was taken via ambulance from Austin, Texas, to the psych ward in Waco, 94 Bravo. I did my time there. I did my time in Temple at the reintegration residential dorms. I did my time at the PTSD clinic in Waco. I tried the meds. I tried it all. That following summer of 2015, I backpacked 1,500 miles across the Sierra Nevada trying to find a purpose for living. I realized that I was walking on my purpose and that being in the backcountry was the only time I truly felt at ease and content. It took two more psych wards, but I managed to land in Reno to be close to the mountains where I lived homeless out of a storage unit until I could afford an apartment. That was last year, chugging beer, smoking cigarettes, and trying to stay warm in a storage unit, looking up at the mountains and wishing I had the money to get the gear to get out there. It was absolute shit. However, this year I got the gear. This year I am in an apartment. I have made a home in a few short months. Haven't smoked a cigarette since I started TBI treatment, a 15-year habit, and haven't had a drink in 2 weeks or more, I guess. I only drink on occasions now. Alcohol does not have a hold over me anymore. In almost 2 years of intensive VA treatment, I have made more progress with Warrior Angels and Doc Gordon in 2 weeks. I'm not knocking the VA. They've helped me a lot. But I knew before I left on my backpacking trip that I had reached the apex in the VA system. They told me I couldn't get any better, that I would just have to live a life of coping. But I always hoped I could get better. When I heard you and the doc on Joe Rogan's show, I was like, that's it. I pulled over at the first Starbucks I saw off the freeway, and right there, I started my application. Maybe people who don't know me don't recognize me because of the change, but I sure do. I recognize a person that I thought was long dead. I feel like I have been given my very own being back. It's like I am becoming the person I was 9 years ago upon discharge, before I felt myself starting to slip. Back then, I had all the hopes, all the confidence, all the motivation to seize life. I joined at 17, had my 18th in infantry training, and my 19th and 20th in Haditha and Fallujah, Iraq. When I discharged, I wanted to get out and experience life so bad, and for a time I did, but it seemed to just keep getting harder. I just keep sinking and sinking for 7 long years till mentally I couldn't take it anymore and I went to treatment. I now know what the fuck was up with anything. And I don't know what the fuck was up with anything, much less why. Well, now I'm back and I'm doubly enthused because instead of 4 years of enlisted life to make up for in the civilian world, I now have 13. It truly feels like I have been given a second chance. And I'm starting to put down new tracks for the first time. It feels damn good to be in control and blazing my own trail again. Thank you from the bottom of my soul. And then he went on a whole paragraph just asking what he could do now to help us, help others. And he finished with great gratitude. And then his name. And, you know, Chris, I have a number. Too many to even list or remember of accounts like that. And now with over 160 people that we've helped, so many stellar reports like that. Absolutely incredible. Here's a young man who made the decision to serve his country. And came out and was ready to take on the world. And he wasn't complaining about anything. He wasn't thinking anybody owed him anything, but he started to sink and he just couldn't understand why. He asked the system to help him, and the help he got was not helpful. And he just continued to sink, finding himself homeless, drinking and smoking his days away until he realized, you know what? I'm through with this. And I don't care if anybody says it can't be done. I don't care how long it takes. I don't care how much money it takes. I'm going to find a way to live a life of purpose again. And sure, we helped him getting everything straight hormonally and getting rid of inflammation, but he had to make the decision. I mean, is that not an incredible story of somebody in 1 year going from just thinking about there's no way out of it to now absolute living the purpose they have created for their life?
Man, that just fired me the hell up. I'm so motivated right now just hearing that story. And you know, both you and I have been there as far as depression goes and dealing with difficulty. I think that when you come out of something like that, it's so crazy because it's almost like the clues were right in front of your face all along, right? The simple decisions that you had to make every day that built up into larger things. And it's crazy when you come out of something like that because you realize that it was always within your grasp. It was always right at the tip of your fingertips. And you always have the opportunity to change every single day. And it's just a matter of, you know, what he was describing there, he was describing himself as being trapped, as being pinned in. And he went from being trapped to seeing a world of possibility. And I think that's one of the things when we look at PTS and the way it's treated in this society. You notice I don't put the D on the end of the S, on the end of PTSD. And the reason why I don't put the D on the end of PTSD is because I don't like to call it a disorder. And the reason why I don't like to call it a disorder is because it makes people think that it's entirely beyond their control, right? And it makes people think that they're abnormal. And if you start to make people think that they're abnormal and that they are trapped into something, then they're going to act that way. They're going to manifest that behavior. But when you give somebody something, you know, and we're talking about a few weeks here, you give this young man some hope. Give this young man let him take charge of something, then he's going to grab it by the reins and he's going to ride that thing out to success. And that is fucking amazing. That it goes beyond anything. That's awesome.
Yeah, it really is, man. You know, and it speaks, like you were talking to Chris, to the power of suggestion. And what I mean by that is tell that individual that, hey, you know what? You have a disorder. You have PTSD. And you know what? Life is never going to be the same. And you're just going to have to learn how to cope with it. And so what do most people do when a medical professional tells them that? They're going to accept that as truth, right? They call it the voodoo hex. You tell somebody that they have 3 months or 6 months to live, guess what? They end up dying in 3 months or 6 months. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because they always use these 3 month increments. It's like 3, 6, 9, or 12 months. But that speaks to the power of suggestion. And so if somebody says it, that person now perceives that to be true. And so what I wanted to talk about, Chris, is how we actually learn this neuroscience behind it and how that can affect something like post-traumatic stress. So we know through a guy named Hebs, Dr. Hebs, and a famous neuroscientist who came up with what's called Hebbian law. Hebb's law says that neurons that fire together, wire together. All right. And so what that means is when we think certain thoughts, neurons are going to fire electrically in the brain, and they're going to form neural networks. So if whatever that thought happens, it continues to happen, it's going to form that network so we can access that information easier, right? And then it goes from that thought into a, and that's in the neocortex. That's the newest part of the human brain. That's the last part of the brain that's evolved. It is the part with all the folds in it that you see when you see any exposed brain. That's the neocortex. If you think a thought long enough and you continue to build those neural networks, it's going to go from the neocortex into the second brain called the limbic brain, the limbic system. The limbic system is where our emotions come from, okay? All emotions are regulated in the limbic brain. And so it goes from a thought to a repetitive thought into the limbic system. From the limbic system, it goes then to the cerebellum and the brainstem. And the cerebellum and the brainstem, what the cerebellum does is that is where we do subconscious behavior, like walking. At one point in time, every single one of us did not have the neural network in our brain for walking. And so that's why you see babies struggling and jiggling and their muscles aren't working right. So many things has to happen in your body for you to be able to take a step. The hamstring has to tighten on one, and it has to let go on the other leg, and the quadriceps have to tighten, and there's just all kinds of processes going on that you don't have to consciously think about for it to happen. You just have to say, I have the intent to go from A to B, and guess what? Your body does it all. Well, that's what where the cerebellum comes in, and those messages then get sent down the brainstem to the spinal cord, to the rest of the body, to then push those messages out. So we think about this. If post-traumatic stress is a traumatic event in someone's life that happens, then that person then recalls that negative event that happened in the past. They can, by thought alone, bring up all of the emotions, everything that the body experienced through its physiology, through its neurochemistry, and everything else in that past can bring it up to the present time, to the present event. And the body is going to replicate what it's feeling off that thought alone, okay? Because it can't look outside. It's just getting this information from the brain that this situation is happening again, and we're going to respond in this way. So when a trauma happens to somebody, whatever it is, horrible as it is, if a person continues to think and bring up those negative thoughts or that trauma, and it continues to elicit that physiological response in the body, they have now just brought that past up into the future. And guess what happens at that point? At that point, your past now becomes your future, because you are going to make, you're going to feel the same way. You're going to think the same way, which will then cause you to say and to make the same choices. So you've just created a Groundhog Day type scenario in the brain first, just by continuing to bring up these negative experiences. And so again, so the thought, new thought, neocortex. Continue to have the same thought, you build a neural network. You know that neurons that fire together, wire together. So if you keep having that thought, that neural network is going to wire together, and it's going to be easier now to replicate that past trauma. Thought then goes to the limbic system, which says, okay, let's produce these emotions. And the limbic system via the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland are then going to send out those chemical messengers to the rest of the body saying, through this thought, we now know to act and feel like this. Rest of the body, respond. And when you do that long enough It then passes through and goes right to the cerebellum and becomes an automatic behavior. And we can do this. We do this with any type of behavior, any type of thinking process, positive as well as negative. And so post-traumatic stress is caused by the amygdala in the limbic system to release cortisol and other stress hormones to react to what they think is an acute stressor in their life. Problem is, it's not acute. It's brought up by thought alone. So that's that process, Chris, where it goes from thinking to doing to now being, all right? And so that says we've thought about it long enough, we've done it long enough, and now that's who we are, because it's gone from a mood to a temperament to a physical trait. And it's happened through a learned process just through that. And oftentimes it's being done so unconsciously by the individual, because who consciously would want to bring up something that they would make them react emotionally to a certain thing? And then when you build those networks over and over and over and over again, that's when somebody hears a loud sound and they want to hit the deck. That's when somebody goes outside and they hear a horn on a car, and now they're afraid of horns. That's when somebody goes to the store, they start having a panic attack, and they say, oh my God, I am just deathly afraid of being in public places and at grocery stores. But really, that's not it. It's the chemical, it's the neurological chemical cascade that's being created by thought, and now it's manifesting physically, and you just all of a sudden become aware of where you are when those things are now coming forth. And so it's not the fact that you're in a grocery store, it's the fact that all of a sudden now you become aware of your emotions and you're trying to correlate it to something. The brain is trying to sync it up to something. And we say it's a store. We say it's loud explosions. We say it's being in public places. But what it is the amygdala being stressed nonstop, and it's running us and causing us to live by the hormones of stress.
Nice. I mean,
that's a pretty cut and dry process, you know, of how it happens, Chris.
As far as your brain goes, I mean, you're constantly remaking the cells in the body. You're constantly remaking the cells in your brain. And, it goes to show if you think like you're in a world of shit, you're going to end up in a world of shit. It's going to happen. You know? So one of the things I think we need to do, we need to be teaching people to do, is to really be a constant observer of your own thoughts and asking yourself, well, why am I thinking? Why am I feeling this fear right now? Why am I feeling this way? What is bringing this on? In really kind of doing these types of journaling exercises that we hear about a lot of different people doing. I've been doing that a lot lately, and that's been helping me out immensely. You know, asking yourself certain questions about, you know, why is this a problem? If there's a problem in your life, ask yourself, why is it a problem? What is causing the problem? How can I solve this problem in on my own terms and things like that? And I think that, you know, as far as everything you guys are doing over there at Warrior Angels Foundation, what I admire about you is that it's not just, hey, here, take a bunch of chemicals and go forth and do these things. You guys are actively trying to get people to decide to improve their lives, you know, and I think that's important, because it's one thing to say, you know, go out there and take this, or go out there and try this, or let's raise awareness about this. But it's another thing to say, all right, well, it comes down to this. You need to make a change in your life. You need to make some sort of behavioral change. And why don't we start with this protocol that we're doing, but let's make some decisions in your life that are going to lead to some better things. Let's make some decisions that are going to get you out of this negative feedback loop.
Exactly. You know, and I want to first and foremost say that I've been diagnosed with PTS. So it's, you know, it is a rated so-called disability. But if anybody has, would like to speak more on it or have any more questions, please send them. And all this is coming from a place of love where I wish I would have had this information, where, you know, life happens, but I didn't have this information when my own personal train started coming off the tracks. And so it's important to understand what happens when we elicit the stress response, the fight or flight response in our own body, which then causes us to live by the hormones of stress. And again, it goes back to, we'll talk some neuroscience here, but we'll break it down where it's really easy to comprehend. The hypothalamus, okay, in the limbic system regulates pituitary gland, which regulates virtually all hormones that are released in the brain to go to the other glands in the body to deliver that message. So the hypothalamus is, it can't see out of your skull. So it is just getting a message through our five senses about what's going on in the outside world. And so when it gets a message that there is a threat, whether it's real or not, it produces a fight or flight mechanism through the pituitary gland, which enables somebody to do just that, to hide, to fight, or to run. And what has to happen when those are at the highest priority? Well, all of our blood that runs all of our organs is stored in our viscera. All right. So that is from about your waist up all the way up to your clavicle, right? That's where all the vital organs outside of the brain remain and stay. And so it is going to, the body needs to mobilize energy. It needs to mobilize blood to fight, hide, or run. So it is immediately going to take that blood out of that viscera, which supports all the organs in your body, and it's going to push it to every extremity that you have. So you can have the energy to do the things that you need to do. But let's talk about when you do that chronically and you live in a chronic fight or flight reality due to thought. What that means is that blood is no longer in the viscera and your body is not worried about proper digestion. Your body is not worried about its immune system. Your body is not worried about making complex decisions, planning for the future, living happily in the present. Why? Because the body thinks we have to mobilize this energy, this blood, to deal with this acute stressor. And if we don't, we won't survive. So also in the brain, it does some very fascinating things. It's going to take the blood that's in the front of our brain, called the frontal cortex, and it's going to move it back to the back of our brain, where we're now, where that's responsible for reflexive behavior. And so now, by definition, we're not able to operate as intelligently as we could or should if we were in a state of balance. That blood has gone back there to the back of the brain, and we are responding to stress. We are in pure reactive mode. And this is why it's easy when you've made this neural network based on past traumas and emotions to stay in there and not be able to figure out that, you know what, the way that I'm thinking is killing me. It's causing me to be less intelligent. It's removing all the blood that I need in my vital organs and pushing it elsewhere. It's opening up my immune system to sickness and disease. And by default, there is bugs and bacterias in our body that we call opportunistic. In other words, there is pathologies that are just waiting for the opportunity to strike. I've been told that virtually every kind of sickness and disease you think is out there, we have in our body already. It's just that our immune system is so strong, it's irrelevant. But when that chronic state happens for so long, that's when these opportunistic bacteria and bugs are going to strike. And what do? They punch holes in the immune system. And it gets it manifests as a symptom, as a sickness, as a disease. But again, if this is coming again from the stress response that is happening from something that is not an acute stress or life or death situation, then it's coming from a learned process that we've taught our body to do. And many times we've taught our body to do it so well that we don't even have to think about it. It just immediately goes into that mode, and that's the place that we get stuck in. And yes, horrible things happen. We've all, a lot of us who've been in the military have been a part of it. But I'm here to tell you, once you can start looking at your past through the lens of not getting emotionally thrown off by it or wrapped up in it, then now you can look at it and that becomes wisdom. When you can look at past events without any emotional ties or attachments to it, you can just purely look at it to, hey, how can I better myself and better everybody else around me without the emotional ties? That's called wisdom. And if we continue to do the opposite of that, we're going to continue to struggle with the term that we've called post-traumatic stress. So what I'm saying is, Chris, it's a decision. Unfortunately, a lot of us don't know that we have the power to start, you know, to make our bodies sick. And we also have the power to make our bodies healthy. And it happens in that cycle right there. You know what I mean? And I haven't heard any other science broken down on post-traumatic stress of how it occurs. And if we're just throwing medications at it, if we're just trying to talk somebody through psychotherapy, if we're just trying to throw other mind-altering drugs about it, if the person cannot go back and look at that past event through the unemotional lens and convert that to wisdom, they're going to continue to produce what was once a past event is now their future, right? And that is critical. How do we stop it? We stop it by becoming conscious of it. We become conscious of our thoughts saying, this thought has not been any good for me. It's not been any good for me. That's step one, right, Chris? That's step one. Catch those thoughts. And then you go through a system of trying to rewrite what's now a subconscious program. And you do it first by becoming conscious of it and stopping it. You know, and we'll outline the steps there. But anything you want to hit on, brother, after that long rant by me?
I mean, no, it's all good, man. I completely hear what you're saying. I think that, yes, it definitely depends on the person and definitely depends on that first step and being able to, like you said, observe your thoughts objectively, observe your past objectively and see the wisdom. I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking about fear. You know, and I was thinking about some of the things that drive fear, you know, fear of making mistakes, fear of screwing up, fear of going out there and taking a chance on something because you think you're going to fail. And I was thinking about, you know, the way we kind of set our society up, you know, when you come out of high school, you meet with guidance counselors, they're talking to you about your options on where you should go, what you're going to do. When you get in the military, you meet with career counselors, they're talking about, you know, your best track for promotion and things like that. When you get out of the military, you meet with people who, are trying to guide you through transition, right? And what I was thinking about was the fact that our society kind of tries to keep us all in this safe space where we are going to be on this kind of path toward perfection, this path toward some sort of ideal, typical life. You know, and we all have in our heads that ideal, typical existence. You have the wife, two cars, picket fence around the house and things like that. And I think in some ways the track record that we place on people who are getting out of the military is in some ways unfair, because you know, we just expect them to come out and just act normal. And in some ways, I don't know that normal is a good thing. I don't think you went into special forces to be normal. I didn't go into the Marine Corps to be normal in the first place, you know? And so I think one of the problems is that the expectations we set for ourselves when we're getting discharged are not really our own expectations. They're expectations that become imposed upon us by society. And because we don't meet those expectations, a lot of the times we end up being disappointed in ourselves and kind of tearing ourselves apart and saying, okay, well, I'm not feeling well right now. So, you know, I'm screwing this up completely and I'm messing my own life up and I don't deserve this. And I maybe they're right about me. Maybe they're right. Maybe I am crazy. I think one of the things we need to think about more is the questions we ask ourselves when we're on that transition period, right? And rather than asking ourselves, well, how can I become successful? You ask yourself, well, what mistakes can I make that I'm going to learn the most from? Right? Because when I think back on it, and I'm sure when you think back on it, you've learned the most probably from your mistakes rather than your successes. Because every mistake you make brings you closer to some semblance of success. You know, every time you screw up, every time, you know, you don't get to where you want to go, every time you feel a little bit of pain, it brings you a little bit closer to where you should be. And I think that rather than being afraid of that and rather trying to embark on these perfect paths of transition or exhibiting no behavior at all, I think that one of the things we need to talk about is, you know, what experiments are we going to do? And if we do screw up, what are we going to learn from it?
Yeah, absolutely, man. And talking about fear, fear of failure, worrying about what society thinks, you know, we do learn from our failures if we're willing to look at it objectively and try to figure out, hey, how can I make better decisions to drive better outcomes? But when you're living by fear, when you're worried about certainty, you know, meaning that, hey, I have to have all these things in place for me to feel protected, for me to feel like I am providing some kind of benefit to somebody else based solely on what they think about me, you know, things like that. When you're living that way, I think that you've limited yourself from going out and taking risk. And that's when you're going to start failing. You're going to start failing when you're doing your best, not trying to live in a life of certainty mapped out by a guidance counselor, a banker, a pastor, whoever, you know, a military transition dude. It comes from realizing, hey, man, how do I live a life worth living? And what would it take for me to manifest that? And then going out and saying, okay, well, if this is the end state, here's where I am now. Let me make some manageable things and chunk it, put it into chunks to make markers that I need to get to. And if I don't get there, then I need to look back at that last chunk or maybe, you know, even more behind that, before that, and say, these are the reasons that I'm not driving the outcomes I think I should be driving. And if you're actually doing your best, those are start coming up and being illuminated really easily, really quickly. But the point is one has to do their best. That doesn't say be perfect. It doesn't say to be something that you're not. It just says to be your best. And guess what? We can always get better. All right. Me and you are going to be better tomorrow. But today we're working as hard as we can to be the best that we can today. And sometimes that means, you know, failing. But failing to me is just, it's data. It's data. It's giving me feedback. It's a feedback mechanism that gives us this readout to say, okay, we need to make some different choices or we need to do something else. You know what I mean, brother?
I don't even think that's failure. I think that's defeat. And there's a difference between defeat and failure. Defeat is when you've actually been trying and you get bloody and you get bruised and, you know, you screw up. And that's what I think think we should all go for being defeated and humbled at some point, right? Failure, and I've said this before, failure doesn't look like anything scary. You know, we're attracted to failure like moss to a light bulb. Failure looks like your couch. It looks like your Xbox. It looks like that pack of cigarettes that Marine was reaching for, the bottle of whiskey. That's failure. You know, we love failure. We go after it. If we don't have anything better to do, that's what we go straight to. And it's like moss to a light bulb. And so I think, again, the thing is, when you're trying to avoid those defeats, that's the problem. You know, when you're trying to avoid getting bloody, that's the problem. It's being safe that leads to failure, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you explained it like that. So that failure that you're speaking about, that's what we were talking about earlier. It's a learned response. And so most people, and I know I'm no different than this, are so resistant to change or anything that they have believed to be truth that it actually physically hurts in their body to think about doing it differently. So if the couch has become comfortable and you don't go outside or you just keep drinking and you don't want to stop, well, guess what you've done in your brain? You've created a neural network that has fired on down the line that has released a certain chemicals. And so what happens is you have got addicted to those chemicals. So fear has a certain chemical cocktail to it, a certain vibrational frequency to it, that now your body has become completely submersed in. And because it's so regular, we think that that's comfortable. And so anything that comes different is going to be fought off. That's where you have to say, enough is enough. I know this isn't the life that I should be leading or the life that I wanted to lead, you know, a few years ago. That's when you have to start making those changes. And it's like, first it comes with, I need to quit thinking this way. Because you're right, Chris, we get so addicted to those chemicals that fear just takes over and we're not able to make a better decision to get out of that chain of events.
Yeah, that's just like our brother Tony says. You know, you got to watch out about getting high off your own shit. Because every single drug that's out there, opiates, methamphetamines, we all have chemicals in our body that create those same sensations. And we're able to produce them. And, you know, it just takes a couple of different things. And some things like dopamine are even more addictive. And we produce it every day, every time we do something pleasurable. So we really got to watch out for that. And again, I think it comes back to things we're both saying here. You know, watch yourself. Observe yourself, you know, really think about why you're doing what you're doing. And, you know, there's resources out there like the Warrior Angels Foundation, and some other good organizations as well, but I really like what you guys are doing that can really help. And that could point you in the right direction. We've got a load of stuff on our website now that's completely free that can help you guys to start something new, to learn about something new, to try something new, and at least point you in the right direction toward taking a new step in your life. And it's those new things. When you try something new, and I'm talking about this now because it's just fascinating to me, but jiu-jitsu, man, you know, a few weeks ago, I was like trying to figure out a way to get out of the house because I hadn't been talking to anybody or anything like that. I'd been in writing mode and creation mode and I needed something. And I was worried about like going out and trying something new or going someplace because I was like, oh dude, I got to get all this work done. But just going out to jiu-jitsu and using some of those neural pathways that I hadn't used since high school or the Marine Corps when I was doing wrestling or doing combatives, it completely revitalized my productivity. It made me feel really good every night. I'm getting so much more energy, so much more of a positive attitude because of it. You know, and it could be something as simple as that. It could be something as simple as, you know, middle of a day, just going outside and breathing in the fresh air, you know, smelling the leaves, you know, going for a walk, feeling the actual air against your skin. You know, it shudders to make me think, you know, because I know there's people out there who don't see the sun on their skin for days, you know, doing small things like that can really, really add to your life and really set you on a path to try and do things, you know?
Yeah. The end result of experience is an emotion. And like we said, if you get caught up in that feedback loop where you're not experiencing anything new, then nothing new is going to happen in your life. So you have to open yourself up. You have to expose yourself to new things, to becoming vulnerable, to doing new things, to seeking new experiences, and then continue to do them at a rate where it just doesn't a one or two time thing. It keeps happening at such a frequent level that positive experience process into the limbic system, goes into the brain, cerebellum and the brainstem. And now what are you doing? You're creating these new positive neural networks by seeking out new experience. And if creating new neural networks is learning, then redoing them over and over is remembering them, is the process of being able to remember it. And that's how we continue to shape our lives for the better. That's how we pull ourselves out of these negative places that we don't want to be in. New experience. We need to drive new experiences. We need to learn new things. That's why I look at like who, what populations out there seem to live the longest and have a high quality of life. A lot of times it's people in academia because they keep their brain sharp, because they continue to learn new things all the way through it. And when you think about that, how many of us aren't seeking to learn new things? How many of us aren't seeking out to have new experiences? We're just caught up in, I'm going to get up at this time. I'm going to have coffee. I'm going to take a shower. I'm going to drive the same way I always drive to work. I'm going to work with the same people that I can't stand working who make me think the same thoughts and have the same emotions. I'm going to have the same boss that I don't care for. I'm going to drive home. I'm going to do and eat the same food. Me and my wife are going to watch the same programs. And then I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to do it all over again. What's changed there when that's your routine? What's new? Nothing. So new experiences, Chris, it's like you said, man, getting out, jujitsu, you know, absolutely.
Absolutely. And another thing that you and I were talking about the other day, and I think that this also adds to things, because anything you put into your body also creates certain responses, right? And that it could be drugs, but what do we put in our body most? Food, right? When we think about what we eat, and I've been studying this for quite a while, and I know you're also fascinated by it, but what we eat can have a serious effect on the way we think. And I didn't realize this until I cut things like sugar out of my life, until I cut things like artificial sweeteners out of my life. Because when I did, all of a sudden things became a whole lot clearer. Now, I've been talking about the ketogenic diet for quite a while. And I'm not necessarily saying that everybody needs to go on the ketogenic diet or anything like that. But one of the reasons why I like the ketogenic diet as a tool so much is because it keeps your blood sugar levels steady, right? So when we think about things like when you eat like a piece of bread or candy or some piece of junk, your insulin levels spike up, your blood sugar levels spike up, insulin gets released in the bloodstream, and then your blood sugar goes way down. Now, a lot of us don't really understand the impact that blood sugar can have on your thoughts, your mood, your appetite, and things like that, but it can be serious. In if you're getting regular spikes in your blood sugar, you know, for example, a lot of people, they'll eat lunch, right? And they'll have like a sandwich, some potato chips, an apple, and things like that, and then be ready for sleep. You know, that 2 o'clock slump that people get. Back when I was in the Marine Corps and we would have our MREs, I remember, you know, trying to fuel up and constantly having a snack on things like pound cake and you know, crackers and things like that that came in the MREs, and constantly feeling like I needed to stick Copenhagen snuff in my eyes to keep them open. I've actually done that. That's not too fun. but you know, there's things that you can do as far as your diet goes. And I'm not saying you have to go full-blown keto, but just eliminating certain junk from your diet can have a huge impact on your mood and can also have a huge impact on the way your brain performs.
Can you talk about the importance of blood glucose and what the actual, what that, why is that process a relevant process in the body? And then, you know, we'll jump into insulin from there.
Yeah. So the big thing about blood glucose is this, right? Your brain is fueled largely off of glucose, right? But you have to understand something about the human body's capacity to store glucose, right? And so you have a limited amount of calories that you can store in your muscle tissue of glucose. You have a limited amount of calories that you store in your liver. But say you're just fueling exclusively off of glucose, what happens when your blood sugar goes low? What happens is your thoughts begin to get cloudy. You begin to get brain fog. You end up getting tired. You might want to take a nap. You don't have the energy that you feel like you should. And your mood starts to fluctuate, because you're lacking the energy, you're getting hungry and things like that. And that in and of itself can trigger a lot of those other types of hormonal cascades that you're talking about.
So eating something that has a lot of sugar in it, or a lot of processed, you know, carbohydrates, that goes into the body. We have a limited amount of glucogen that we can store in the body. I've read up to like 2,000 calories. And then after that, any surplus of glucogen gets stored as fat. Is that a correct statement? Right. And so then how by eating sugar or carbs would make your blood glucose level spike or drop, Chris? And again, if you don't, I know you're not a doctor, but you're well read on this. But do you know the answers to that?
It all has to do with the amount of insulin you're using, right? And so for those who don't know what insulin is a hormone. And its job is to shuttle nutrients throughout the body to where they need to go. So its job is to send nutrients to one of three places. It sends them to your muscle tissue. It sends them to your liver, or it sends it to your fat stores. If your muscle tissue and your liver are full and they've reached their capacity to store glucose or glycogen, they become glycogen when they get into the cells, then your body shuttles them straight to the fat cells. Now, what happens when you eat a lot of sugar, or a fast-moving sugar, they call them simple sugars, or, you know, bread or anything like that, you release more insulin. And the more insulin you release, the more rapidly the sugar in your blood starts to go down, right? Now, remember that your brain is fueled off of your blood sugar. So as soon as that blood sugar starts to go down, as soon as insulin comes out and starts shuttling that blood sugar into the muscle cells rapidly, and then starts shuttling it into the fat cells after the muscle and liver are all filled up, then the brain's fuel supply starts to go down. And so that's when you start to get drops in blood sugar after eating a significant amount of carbohydrates.
So we're in so much overload by what we've put into our body that the glucogen, the sugar in the brain that we would use to function normally is taken up by the process of actually transporting that fast acting sugar elsewhere in the body.
Correct. And not only that, every time you release that hormone, what's happening is each cell has a receptor site on it. Right? And so the muscle and liver cells, they each have receptor sites on the outside. Just like, say, you were taking high doses of testosterone, right? And you weren't taking DHEA, and you weren't taking pregnenolone, and you weren't taking things to sustain yourself. what happens when you stop taking that exogenous source of testosterone?
Right. It no longer works.
No longer
works. On its own.
Right. So similarly, when insulin is constantly being bombarded against those cells, what happens with the human body that we know from the work with the Warrior Angels Foundation? It seems
Inflammation, right? It leads to inflammation.
Well, and I'll get into the inflammation, but the body always seeks homeostasis, right? So
yes.
The body is going to not respond anymore to those messages. Like if you knock too much on anything on the human body, it just stops responding.
Right.
And so what happens is rather than going, it makes it less likely that insulin is ever going to be able to get glucose into the muscle cells. Right. So the more insulin resistant you become, the more fat you store. And so you start to get things like love handles, visceral fat, and things like that. Now, here's where the inflammation.
That's the word. Okay. I'm going to say before that, that's the word, right, Chris, when that of that process, it's insulin resistant. That means that the insulin just can no longer do its job because it's been overtaxed for so long.
Exactly. Insulin resistant. Okay. Now, when we think about what happens with fat, right? And this is the thing that people don't get about fat. There's good fat in your body, right? So there's benign fat, and that tends to be gathered around your legs, and you also have brown fat, brown adipose tissue that's gathered around your shoulders that can help to burn fat. But visceral fat, it is kind of its own animal. It's there to protect the internal organs. And so because it's there to protect the internal organs, what it does is it starts to filter out a lot of the toxins that could potentially hurt us. And so all that gets stored up in there, right? And fat is actually not just something that hangs out underneath your skin. It's an internal organ in and of itself. It produces hormones. And so fat helps to also create inflammation in the body, because if you're throwing up all these toxins at it, then that's going to trigger off your body's inflammatory processes, because your body is in a constant state of trying to protect itself. So it sends off chronic inflammation, and that can lead into a whole host of other issues, increasing more insulin resistance. It can lead to total body aches, joint problems, can lead to brain inflammation, can lead to a whole host of other issues. So basically,
type 2 diabetes,
type 2 diabetes, heart disease, which we now know is caused by inflammation, cancer. The big three.
Here's another one, Chris, that many doctors want to start calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes.
Yeah.
Because of essentially what you just said, and that sends those inflammatory chemicals that disrupts that beta amyloid plaque, which we know disrupts that in the brain and is basically the root cause of that neurodegenerative disorder.
Yep.
And inflammation is the root of all neurodegenerative disorders.
Yeah, the book Grain Brain by Dr. David Perlman.
Yeah.
That goes through that process in extreme detail. And that book, honestly, when I picked it up the first time in an airport, and it changed my perspective on a lot of things. That was one of the first books that led me toward a lot of this line of thinking. But, you know, back to what we were thinking about as far as, you know, things you can do, simple things you can do to really improve your state of being. Well, like I said, one of them is taking care of getting rid of most of that sugar out of your diet, because that in and of itself will take care of a lot of the body aches you have. It'll take care of your joint aches. It will help to increase your sustainable energy. It will decrease your inflammatory processes. It'll lower your blood sugar. And that in and of itself can help you to think with a more clear head. Now, the second step to that is, even if you're not ketogenic, to include fats in your diet. And the reason why you want to include fats in your diet is because fats actually have a very awesome anti-inflammatory process of their own. You know, when we're talking about things like omega-3s, specifically omega-3s, we had the author of When Brains Collide here.
Dr. Mike Lewis.
Dr. Michael Lewis, and he was talking about the extraordinary anti-inflammatory power of omega-3s, but you have to watch the amount of omega-6s you're taking in, the vegetable oils, the nuts, and things like that, because those can promote inflammation. But, you know, getting things like fish oil into your diet, getting things like regular seafood in your diet. If you're a vegetarian, you know, doing things like spirulina, things like that can get a source of omega-3s into your diet can really, really help you think better. And of course we can get into what the ketogenic diet is, and I'm just not trying to push anybody toward anything specific or anything like that. My point is just to simple things you can do to kind of clean things up and to really help to put yourself in a better mood.
Well, here's a fascinating thing about the ketogenic diet that I was delving into further, and that, you know, a whole wheat grain gets turned into what after you ingest it? Sugar, right?
Yep. Yep.
And so we're doing all these things that we were thinking is really good for us. And I was shocked to find, you know, that's just not the case. All these things that are coming from wheat or grains the body doesn't see any difference. It's sugar, and it's going to process it as sugar. Right, Chris?
Right. And here's something that's freaking crazy. Now, I had Ben Greenfield on the show. Episode 19. And I specifically had him on for a reason. He's the author of a book called Beyond Training. And what he looked at in the first chapter of the book, I think it was triathletes, right? And so if you think about triathletes during the 1980s and 1990s, the way they were eating and training, they were doing lots of long distance runs. They were on a diet that consisted mostly of whole wheat, like whole wheat peanut butter sandwiches, pasta every night, wheat germ, all these oatmeal with bananas and things like that. And it was like 60 to 80% carbohydrates. Look at the fatality rate of triathletes. And Ben goes through it in the first chapter of the book. They were dropping like flies, heart attacks, you know, torn aortic valves, severe heart disease, right? Why? It's because of the inflammation, because of the insulin resistance. And it wasn't until they started, you know, athletes started getting into the ketogenic diet that you started to see this coming down. Now, if you read a lot of the main running publications, they still, for some reason, advocate a high carbohydrate diet, but most of the top endurance athletes these days are high fat athletes. And they just did, some people say that you can't perform on a high carbohydrate diet. Dr. Jeff Bullock from the University of Connecticut just released a study in 2015. And what they did was they took, I think it was a group of 30 to 50 ultra endurance athletes. These are athletes who run 100 miles or more. I could be wrong on that number. But what they did was they had half the group eat a high carbohydrate diet and the other half of the group eat a high fat ketogenic diet for 6 months. They brought them in for a trial run, and it was a 3-hour run. And during the run, they took muscle biopsies. They took saliva. They took, sweat samples and breath samples. And what they found amongst the ketogenic athletes was, one, they had a much more extraordinary rate of fat oxidation, right? Now, what that means is that they became fat burning machines. They were literally mobilizing their fat on the spot to provide energy for them, right? Now, remember what I said about the difference between fueling yourself with fats and fueling yourself with carbohydrates. When you fuel yourself with carbohydrates, you have a limited supply of calories available to you. When you fuel yourself with fats, I mean, even if you have 8% body fat on your body, you have thousands upon thousands of calories available for you to mobilize, right? And so you don't have that limited supply. The high carb diet guys had to, you know, sip on things through the whole run in order to keep their energy going. The fat adapted guys did not. The next thing that happened was the recovery rates. The recovery rates were as good or better than the high carbohydrate guys, right? So in this trial, in this experiment, which actually is, it's one of the most groundbreaking experiments ever done on this type of split. They demonstrated that not only were they able to do the ketogenic high fat people able to do this stuff, they were able to increase their performance through a ketogenic diet, right? And so, what drives me and what drives me along this line of thinking, what also haunts me, is the type of stuff we're giving guys out in the field in the military. When we think about what was happening to triathletes in the 1980s and 1990s, knowing the amount of inflammation that kind of dieting was causing, knowing that a lot of our guys, you know, I think up until recently, you know, the military, at least when I was in, we were doing long distance runs, long humps all the time, being out in the field all the time, and eating a high carbohydrate diet. Right. So what you're setting them up for right then and there is an environment that's conducive for inflammation from the beginning, from their nutrition. And then God, you know, when somebody goes and gets a traumatic brain injury, what happens there? You know, completely non-neural permissive environment, complete inability to help that situation. Somebody gets a rolled ankle. You know, and it might not affect them while they're young between the ages of 18 and 22, but what happens when, you know, they're 27, 28 and they've been doing that for that long? Or what happens when they get out of the military and they stop doing all the physical activity at all and their body still has all that inflammation, you know? Plus on top of that, most of the guys I served with, we dipped Copenhagen, smoked cigarettes, drank beer, things like that too. So,
dude, I was thinking, man, like when I was operating, obviously I had never heard of the ketogenic diet, but if I was still operating now, you know what I mean? I would be if I was running the show, I run my team, I would check all my guys' ketone levels before every mission. And I'd be like, you know, if somebody was severe, obviously they're going to still do the mission, but I'm going to say, hey man, monitor or how you feel on this mission first. And I would track the guys who were in a state of ketosis. And I think it would become evident that that's much better. Why? Because if you have to go 12, 24, 36 hours and you're in ketosis, now you're not reliant on that garbage to put in your body. You're running, the body's running off of itself, right? So we just put back some essential salts back into our body and we're ready to rock and continue to perform at a high, high level. And again, what my understanding is, Chris, is that when you're in ketosis, the brain is running about 75% off of fat and the other 25% off of sugar. And that's sugar that your body has then changed from fat into sugar. And I know you know more about that. Can you talk on that process and how does the body, if it doesn't take in sugar, how does it produce sugar out of this fat to meet those minimum sugar requirements that the body does actually need when in ketosis?
So here's the thing. You actually don't need sugar when you're in ketosis at all. You can still remain in ketosis when you're at a very low percentage of sugar or carbohydrates as calories. Basically, what happens is your body has to go through what's called a keto adaptation phase, right? And during the keto adaptation phase, basically you severely restrict carbohydrates for a period of like 10 to 15 days. And you start to consume a diet that is 80% fat, maybe 20% protein, or maybe 15% protein, 5% um, 5% carbohydrates, right? You could also do different splits that I've seen it as 70% fat, 20% protein, and 10% carbohydrates. But most people, it's the higher the number, the higher the percentage of fat, the quicker you're going to get it in ketosis. Now, once you've been carbohydrate and glucose restricted for a while, your body starts converting your fat stores via your liver into ketone bodies. And there's two types of ketone bodies. There's one called beta hydroxybutyrate. And then the other one, I can't remember, it's a more complicated name, but beta hydroxybutyrate is the main one. And once you get into ketosis and your body's doing this, your liver starts sending a steady stream of these ketone bodies up to your brain to fuel it. Now, the beauty of this is that there is no fluctuation according to insulin levels, right? All you're doing is sending a steady stream. So your energy is constant throughout the whole thing. Now, the other thing that we have to think about is, well, what types of fats are going to get us into ketosis the quickest, right? So when somebody's trying to adapt, a good way of doing things is using things that have what they call medium chain triglycerides. Medium chain triglycerides, they're shorter chain fatty acids. And because of that, they bypass the liver and go straight into the bloodstream to fuel the brain. Now, this can start to get your brain used to burning fats. So that's when you see people taking MCT oil and they're putting it into bulletproof coffee. The reason why they're doing that is for the added and extra energy. It also helps to shuttle some of the caffeine across the brain-blood barrier and creates a more sustained caffeine high without a crash. But MCTs, you can get straight up MCT oil, or you can get them from coconut oil. You take a large amount of coconut oil and MCT oil when you're in the adaptation phase. And then the other thing they have now, it's been developed by guys like Dr. Dominic D'Agostino and Patrick Arnold, is exogenous ketones. And exogenous ketones are actually shelf stable beta hydroxybutyrate that they powdered down and put into a drink that you can take. And so if I were heading out to the field, and it was today and I know what I know now, the two things I'd have with me are little packets of MCT oil or coconut oil, and maybe a packet of exogenous ketones to take before we're heading out. And I've taken them before. And I can tell you that when I have taken them, I've been extremely productive. Lots of energy, not a lot of hunger or anything like that. It is a temporary ketosis because you're using an exogenous ketone to create ketosis. Your body didn't naturally get into it that way. While you're in that adaptation phase, until your body actually adapts into ketosis, it can help. Because the other thing that happens, and this is why the ketogenic diet is not so popular, during that 10 to 15 days that you're adapting, you feel like hell. You get what's called the keto flu, and you get headaches. And anytime your body's switching energy systems like that, on top of detoxing from an addiction to sugar, you know, your body's going to respond in ways that you might not like it. So if you're thinking about doing this, one, I suggest reading up on it quite a bit. There's a few books that I'll put in the show notes for it. And two, you know, don't do it during a time period where you need to be productive like crazy.
So Chris, by taking exogenous ketones, will that bridge that gap, so to speak, where you don't necessarily have to have a horrible, you know, process going into keto adaptation mode?
Right. It could definitely attenuate it. It can attenuate it, and it keep you from getting those severe headaches, those severe migraines that can come along, the dips in energy, the moodiness and things like that.
You might've already touched on it, but what is, and I might be messing up the word, so correct me if I'm wrong, gluconeogenesis.
Yeah. It's gluconeogenesis.
Gluconeogenesis. Got it.
Yep. So this is the other thing in where people get confused, because a lot of bodybuilders, when they're preparing for a bodybuilding competition, will do a high protein, low carb, low fat diet, right? And they'll confuse this with a ketogenic diet because it's a low carbohydrate diet, right? And a lot of people will vilify ketogenic diets because they think that ketogenic diets are the same as this kind of diet. There's a huge problem when you're doing a really high protein diet and trying to go into ketosis. And the reason why it's a huge problem is because as you are trying to get into ketosis and you limit your carbohydrate intake, what happens is your body finds a way to get fuel. So if you're not consuming fat, and if you are consuming a lot of protein, your body is going to find a way to get glucose, because glucose is honestly its preferred fuel burning fuel source. And so when we think about people who eat tons of protein, what happens is your body starts converting that protein into glucose via what they call gluconeogenesis. And so what will happen with a lot of these bodybuilders, they'll be eating like 400, 500 grams of protein a day, even 200 grams of protein a day. And a lot of that, a large percentage of that protein starts to get converted by the liver into glucose, and it becomes carbohydrate, and it raises your insulin levels and knocks you out of ketosis. So
bro, that right there is what caught the most attention from me when I heard that, because that was shocking to me. I was like, wait a minute, protein, excess protein, you're telling me it's converted into sugar, which spikes insulin and can make us insulin resistant? I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
How long I've been like thinking that you need like 2 or 3 grams of protein per kilogram if you're going to be competitive in anything. I was like, how long have I been abusing my body and didn't even realize it, thinking that I was eating correctly, doing a low carb and hitting tons of protein. I was like, holy shit, dude, I guarantee you I'm insulin resistant, and I had no fucking clue.
Oh yeah, dude. I did. So back when I was a bodybuilder, I went and got my blood tested, and I was a very low body fat percentage. I was probably like 7-8%. And I'm talking like a few years ago when I was heavy into NPC competitions. I hadn't eaten carbohydrates in weeks. I went and got my blood tested. I was pre-diabetic because I was eating 350 grams of protein a day. Could you?
Yes.
And it blew my mind at the time. But that's one of the reasons why I started looking into things and started studying things. Now, think about this too. You're converting protein from meat into sugar. What happens during that process? There's a chemical conversion that happens in your body. What happens when you have chemical conversions in your body? Toxins get released.
Right, right.
All the byproducts. So not only are you...
Not to mention that is you taking energy to add that extra step to rob you of the energy you could have put towards something else.
Right, right. And that is... That also, I mean, that's one of the reasons why bodybuilders do it, because they call it the thermogenic effect of food. And so protein burns way more energy because it's harder to digest, it's harder to process. But you're also releasing sulfur and ammonia and all these other things that can cause and raise inflammatory levels. And all of these things can play into all of the stuff that we're talking about earlier. You know, I think at the end of the day, if you look, because I've done this, I've looked amazing. I've gotten on bodybuilding stage. I've won competitions. But if you look like a masterpiece and you feel like a garbage dump, that's not worth it to me. I mean,
what's the point, right?
Yeah.
Right.
For some people, it might be. But if I can't run up a flight of stairs, if I can't do simple math, if I can't write, if I can't do my job, because my brain's mushy, if my relationship's gone to shit because I don't have energy at the end of the day, then that's going to have a negative quality on my life. And you know, that the trophies I have over here behind me, they're not worth it. You know, and if I could take some of that time back, you know, I learned from it and everything like that. But if I could take some of that time back, that would have been pretty cool. So,
well, let's talk about you performing on the ketogenic diet, because I've seen the pictures from your last event, which you were absolutely fucking jacked, and you were running the ketogenic diet on that one, correct?
Right. I'd been doing the ketogenic diet for a few years now.
And okay.
Just to refresh people, I don't know if they've heard me talk about this on YouTube, but the way I came to ketosis was out of desperation. And I hadn't even read anything about it. I was going through a really, really bad ulcerative colitis flare. Like, I'm bleeding quite a bit. I was near anemic, and I needed to figure out something. I couldn't eat. And so I started to assess what was making me, have the attacks. And so, I would eat individual foods by themselves, and try to determine what kind of effect it was having on my digestion, and whether or not it was making me run to the bathroom. And so I got down to figuring out that the only two things that weren't making me run to the bathroom were grass-fed beef and coconut oil. And so, what I would do was I would eat, one meal a day. I would have grass-fed beef, and then the rest of the day I would have coconut oil, and I'd mix it up in coffee. And so I was drinking that all throughout the day. Now, I was expecting to become this skinny fat, like emaciated looking, person, because it had been drilled in my brain. If you're not eating 8 meals a day, if you're not eating, you know, 300, 400 grams of protein a day, you're going to get skinny fat. If you're not eating carbohydrates, you're going to get skinny fat. But after a few really difficult, days, during a week long period, all of a sudden I started to feel really good. Right. And then I said, all right, let me get over to the gym. I went over to the gym and started training. A couple of weeks later, I'm looking at myself and I'm like, whoa, like what the heck is going on here? I'm getting more and more muscular, more and more lean. Squatting really heavy at the time. Like I was squatting, you know, I was just cracking 200 pounds at the time, about 180 now. But, I was squatting 405 pounds for reps. Like it was nothing, butt to the grass and everything. I was doing all kinds of amazing things. And I was like, why the hell is this working right now? So that's when I started doing a lot of reading. I read, Dr. Jeff Bullock and Stephen Finney's book, The Art and Science of Low Carbohydrate Performance. I started getting into Perlmutter. I started, looking at a lot of the things that Dominic D'Agostino was working on as far as ketones go. And what I've discovered was, I have a ebook that we have on the site too. There's a bunch of articles on our blogs, but, there's a few things about the ketogenic diet that a lot of people don't understand. One, the reason why, one of the ways that ketosis was used was to keep people from muscle wasting. So when you take your dependence off of glycogen, which stores in the muscles, you actually, ensure that your body is not going to focus on muscle as its primary method of catabolism, right? So it's not going to try and eat your muscle for energy. It's going to go after your fat stores. And as long as you have enough fat stores to fuel yourself, then you're going to get leaner, right? And that's where you're going to really start to see some muscularity and things like that. And because you're sparing muscle tissue, you're not going to lose strength. You're not going to lose energy. You're not going to lose functionality. So that's pretty freaking awesome. The other thing was that the ketogenic diet was originally used to treat epilepsy, to stop people from getting seizures, because what they were finding was that those insulin fluctuations were actually having an effect on the frequency of seizures. So that's one of the reasons why my brain was working so well and why I was so productive. And then, you know, as I moved forward into it, I started to feel like I had unending energy. You know, your mitochondrial density, it has a huge effect on your mitochondrial density. And I was able to really get a lot better endurance than I had. I was able to run a Spartan race, and I maintained my body weight while training for that Spartan race, because it's always been hard for me to be around 200 pounds. While I was training for that Spartan beast, I stayed at 200 pounds. Not only that, and this is a completely anecdotal story, but I went to Electric Daisy Carnival. Now, I know everybody's going to be like, hey, you know, techno hippie and everything like that, but it's a rave out in Las Vegas with my girlfriend. Give me a break. She's 10 years younger than I am. But we went out there, and I didn't eat anything but coconut oil. I barely drank water. I was dancing, moving all over the place in the desert sun for 3 days. I come back that day. We go right to the gym, and I had a personal best on the front squat at 385 pounds. And at this point, I was probably 195 pounds.
Dude, that's so crazy, man. That's so wild. And that's one of the reasons, a lot of the reasons I've been like diving in, man, is your personal experience and bringing this new knowledge to light. But just keeping yourself in a ketogenic state, going for 3 days, nonstop raving, having a good time. I didn't sleep much. Then go right into the gym and do a PR in the front squat. It's unheard of.
Yeah, dude. And then the last bodybuilding show, which was one of these, and I'll post a picture of it in the show notes. I was eating one meal a day.
Yeah.
I was eating one meal a day. I would have, you know, like I said, I would have coconut oil, MCT oil, grass-fed butter, things like that. But I would eat like one solid meal a day, and I was eating under 60 grams of protein a day. So that's the thing. Protein, in my opinion, is an essential nutrient, but it's so overrated in terms of building muscle. The actual research says that you only need about 0.45 to 0.6 grams at the most to build muscle. That's per pound of body weight. The whole 1, 2, 3 grams of protein per pound of body weight. If you're doing that, the likelihood is that you're probably just poisoning yourself and taking yourself out of an optimal state.
Yeah, it's bro science, right?
Yeah, exactly. And again, my point is not to push the ketogenic diet on anybody. I think there's a lot of ways to do things, and there's, you know, I think that every person is different. There shouldn't be one cookie cutter approach to this, but this is a potential tool for one, all you active duty service members out there. Like I know it would be hard to put it together, but if it was possible to include things like coconut oil and exogenous ketones in your kit, you know, I think that those are definite tools that could help you. And two, to just get rid of sugar, out of our lives, to keep those inflammatory levels a little bit lower while you're active duty and while you're a veteran. And even if you're just a civilian out there, we could all benefit from having less processed sugar in our lives and less inflammation. And it could point us toward a really awesome course for ourselves.
No doubt. And if you guys don't know out there, obviously Chris, in addition to being having been a world class at bodybuilding, he's a world class trainer, and he has lots of high profile clients. But so this is somebody who knows what he's talking about, and he's implemented in his own life. And he'll put the pictures in the show notes. Take a look, man. I mean, he is a impressive physique, to say the least. But here's what we're going to do. Chris is going to train and coach me to get into ketosis, and he's going to take over the training program, and we're going to monitor it and measure it for the next 90 days, and we'll make that public to everybody along the way. So anybody that's wanting to learn more about this, who's wanting to replicate it, or wondering, you know, can I do this? We'll put together a solid program, and we'll tape, you know, me going through the process, Chris coaching me through the process, and we'll publish the results, whatever they are. But we'll all be better for it because we'll have a model here of how somebody can actually apply this to their life.
Absolutely. And not only that, Andrew, what we're going to do here is we're going to be creating a gathering point for everybody that if they want to do experiments like this on themselves, if they want to do a trial run with ketosis, if they want to, you know, figure out what things they should be looking for in their own blood to really increase the performance or to figure out these types of problems. If you're trying to start an exercise routine and you need to know the basics, if you are trying to figure out how to perform at your peak mentally and try to find your own flow state, we're going to be putting all this stuff out there for free. And it's going to come out there very shortly in our new Warrior Soul Life Academy. I think that's what we're going to call it. We might decide to call it something else down the line, but there's going to be an opportunity for all of you out there to try this stuff and not only try it, but to really come together as a community and to bounce things off of each other, because it's not just about what you talk about. It's what you do. It's what you do at the end of the day. And, if we just sit here and talk about this stuff and we don't guide you guys toward your own best life, then, you know, at the end of the day, it's something different. You know, we had, like I said at the beginning of the show, we had somebody who was supposed to come on to this show today, canceled on us 20 minutes before. And he was somebody who claims that he's trying to help veterans and things like that. And he might be. I think that the research that he's doing is amazing. But he missed an opportunity to talk to his base that he was going to be speaking to. And we don't want to be like that here. We want to really give you something that's going to make an impact on your life, that is going to have be something that you do at your home, you know, immediately this week, today, the next hour, and things like that. So, so be on the lookout for that.
Yep, it's solutions based. It's taking action based, proactive based. That's what Warrior Soul is all about. Taking these things so we can put them into our mix to live our best lives, so we can improve ourselves, elevate ourselves, and elevate everybody that we come across. And that's how we continue to make this a better place. So super stoked, Chris, to get the Academy up and running and get all this and open sourcing all this information. You know what I mean? Just because it's the right thing to do.
100%, man. It's going to be awesome. And I can't wait to see what kind of awesome changes, what more awesome changes we can make in this community and you know, what kind of successes and awesome things that people do as a result of it. Cause I'm sure that all the amazing veterans that we have in this community, the one thing that I've seen is that every one of them wants to help. Every one of them, there's not a veteran I've ever run into that doesn't want to help other veterans, that doesn't want to help this country become better, that doesn't want to help their communities become better. And that's what makes me so excited about doing this stuff. So, what else do we have coming up this week? We've got some new awesome shirts that came out in our lifestyle line. We just created one that says, fear is a liar. And it's got a skull and crossbones on it, and it says death comes for us all. And I wanted to design that one because, and the reason why I'm talking about it is because it really gets down to a message that I think is primary for this podcast. And that is that you have a limited time on this earth. You have a limited number of days you're going to be here. And 100 years from now, everybody, you know, me, Andrew, unless some of this technology gets going, most of us are going to be dead, right? And you need to live while you're here. You know, why spend 1 second, 1 instant in misery? You know, happiness is not worth it. Unhappiness is not worth it. And unhappiness comes from fear. And fear, at the end of the day, is a manifestation of your mind that you're accepting. It's a liar. And its only job is to keep you from doing the things that you want to do with your life. Think about that. Are you going to give it that control? Are you going to give it the ability to tell you what to do? Or are you going to take this one chance that you have, knowing that in this great, vast universe, you were given the gift of life on this planet, in this country, in the Western world, where you have access to information, to running water, to books, to anything you want in a matter of instance? Are you going to take this opportunity and are you going to run with it? Because if you don't, you're a fool. You've got to decide to do it. That's all I got as far as everything today. Andrew, you want to add anything to that?
No. Oh. Cool, man. That's it, man. You summed it up. I thought it was beautifully stated. I'm excited about the Warrior Soul Ranger panties. So look for me in some pictures and some cool places coming up in 2017 in the Warrior Soul Ranger panties. That's silkies for the Marines. What are they calling?
That's going to be the uniform, Ranger panties and silkies. So that's going to be the uniform whenever we take road trips. If we ever have public events and everybody's got to gather, we're not wearing suits, brothers. Everybody's wearing Ranger panties and silkies, but
no doubt. Excited about that. Excited about the new hoodie. Some good stuff out there.
Awesome stuff, man. Cool, guys. So that wraps up Warrior Soul Podcast episode 28. And from Chris and Andrew, live your best life, guys. Have a good week.